accession number 18498, reel 2.
John Howe, reel 2.
Okay. I was explaining how if we were attacking bunkers, you'd thump your 500-pounders with 8-second delay fuses, the first two aeroplanes, and they would blow the tops off the bunkers, and then the next lot would go in and napalm the holes in the ground, and of course we'd get them that way. But we, as I said, anything that moved, we attacked. Looking back on it, it was quite horrendous, actually. Horses, camels, cattle, farmers, tractors, anything that moved north of that bomb line, we attacked. Individuals, and it then got to the stage, because that was so effective, nothing moved during the day. So we had established complete air superiority, and the reinforcements were not coming down, or the supply was not coming down during the day, which gave them problems. So what they used to do then was they'd travel at night. They would, say, arrive at a village, and they would conceal the trucks in and around the village. And sometimes they would knock a wall of a building out and drive the vehicles in and then hang camouflage down. And when we found this out, I mean, we were flying low. You'd fly down the main road of a village looking in as you went by. Slightest glint, you'd know there was something there. But my first few sorties, I mean, you're so busy concentrating on not losing your formation that you basically fired where your leader fired and rocketed where he rocketed and dropped your bombs where he... And eventually, after 6-10 sorties, you began to keep the big picture, see where all the other aeroplanes were, and then pick out your own target on the ground. So you would see where your leader hit, and you'd pick your target so you weren't always firing at the same one.
I noticed from your logbook that on one day, 16th of June, you put attempted rescue of Scotty. What does that mean?
Scotty was a friend. He was an American. And the system there was that each time you took off on a mission, you had on in your mind, and sometimes on your map, the area which you would fly to where they could get a rescue helicopter to you. And it didn't matter what the opposition was. If you were seen alive on the ground and they could get you out, regardless of the losses, they'd get you out. And this was a tremendous morale boost. Anyway, that particular day, I remember Scotty, he was shot down, and there was low cloud. And we just hung around, and we couldn't find him. So he was taken prisoner.
Did you hear about him afterwards?
No, never saw him again.
What about...
Well, I assume he was taken prisoner because he'd bailed out.
What about the enemy's possession of an air force? Did you come across that?
Not personally. But they did have an air force. And they used to... Because of the overwhelming air support we had, their air force was based north of the Yalu, i.e. in China. And consequently, we couldn't go north of the Yalu to attack them or even follow them if we were having a dogfight. And so they would take off and fly south normally at a reasonably high altitude. And that's when the F-86s and the Australians in their Sabres would engage them. But every now and again, you'd get one or two through, and one or two guys were shot down, but generally we didn't see much opposition in the air. Our main problem was flak. We lost a lot of aeroplanes, a lot of chaps. Our squadron establishment was the CO, 24 pilots and 24 aeroplanes. And in the summer of 51, we couldn't put 8 into the air. We had to borrow aeroplanes from the Americans to put up 2 flights of 4.
What was the nature of the enemy flak?
Oh, from what looked like radar-controlled high caliber down to machine gun. The problem with the Mustang was that it was liquid-cooled, the engine, and the radiator was behind the cockpit and underneath the aircraft. And so you had, I don't know, but a lot of piping between the radiator and the engine. And you just needed a chink taken out of a pipe, and in 20 minutes you were on fire. I mean, we had several guys blown out of the sky, just straight out of the sky, but most of them were shot down because they had engine failure, if they weren't blown out of the sky.
What was the technique which was adopted for dive bombing?
As I recall, we had 2. There was the steep angle, which I suppose is about 60 degrees. This was with the 500 pounders. And we would then have the shallow angle, which we used with the... Oh, we had in the high angle, for instance, if we had fuses that would fire off at a barometric fuse, which we would use if we were flak busting on a particular flak busting mission, then you would go in from a high level, drop down steeply, drop your bombs, pull out, and the bombs would explode at a couple of hundred feet of ground and spread the blast. So you would then get a much wider area of destruction. If you had a target that didn't say you had delayed action fuses, you used to go in at about 15-20 degrees, and basically, because there was a delay fuse, I remember my flight commander telling me, you fly at the target, when you think you're going to hit it with your aeroplane, drop your bombs and pull. I.e. you flew the weapon basically straight into the ground or the target you were trying to hit. And then the 8 to 10 seconds, you'd be a long way away when the bombs went off.
How did you like doing dive bombing?
I loved it all. I got the odd fright, but generally I enjoyed it. Mad.
You put one entry here, which is not clear to me. It says, diverted to Jefferson 6, who needed enemy troop concentrations attacked. What does that mean?
Jefferson 6 was the call, I remember that mission, was the call sign of our controller. So basically, as you went north across the border, you checked out with the headquarters on radio. And if there was nothing more for you to do, they would tell you to carry on as briefed. On this occasion, we were recalled, or we were told to change our mission and report to Jefferson 6, and they would give you a channel. we called Jefferson 6, and there was a situation on the ground where our troops were facing a tremendous onslaught, and there's a lot of flak, and there's a lot of fighting going on the ground, and our leader picked us all out and led us down, and we went there. I remember the enemy was along a ridge, and we had napalm, so the first thing we did was to cover the ridge in napalm, and that would take care of most of the troops on there. And then we went round and we fired our rockets at a variety of targets, guns. I mean, the fighting there was quite hard, and the flak was coming up past us. And it took us quite a while to get rid of all our weapons. And we then went back to base. And what happens on a sortie like that, or if you're on the ground and you retake a position, you count the number of enemy killed. And you get a report of the effectiveness of your mission. And I remember we'd killed over 400 troops, over 200 troops, and we'd knocked out a variety of guns and things like that. And because the flak was so intense all the time, I think our leader, Gus, got an immediate award of the DFC, and we were given an immediate award of the Air Medal. But the interesting thing about Gus was a very religious man, Church of England. After the war, he left the Air Force and he became a missionary in Central Africa. But the fighting at one stage was just so awful. He'd had enough. He said, "I'm not going to kill anymore." And the CO said to him, "Gus, you better just sit and think what you're saying. Because if you go like that, then you're finished." At the stage, we were losing a lot of guys. And I think Gus decided then he better continue with the war, which he did. And he was a tremendous leader and a super chap. Gus Marshall is his name.
So was that because he was apprehensive about being accused of cowardice or something?
No. No, he could never be accused of cowardice. I mean, his reputation as a leader and fighter was well known. It was just, I mean, I look back on it now. I'm nearly 70. And I look back on the slaughter, and I can hardly believe it. I can just hardly believe it. Things that I've seen as I was about to drop my napalm, I've seen an infantry come over a ridge as I've let the weapons go. And I've turned around and seen being taken out. I've seen people fall to pieces in my machine gun fire. Arms fall off. I know it's far worse, and as I saw later on when I was with the infantry, it's far worse on the ground, because you can hear and smell and see. But it was just awful. It was quite a big war, and there was very little mercy shown either side.
Did you ever feel that you couldn't go on?
No. I'd got to the stage where half my friends had been killed. I couldn't get enough killing. I didn't know anything about communism. I didn't understand you know, what all the implications of this communist invasion of South Korea was. All I knew was the North had invaded the South and we'd gone to help the South. And basically we, and chaps like me, we weren't fighting for any cause because we didn't understand it. We were just fighting to make our squadron the best and to, what should I say, make them pay for killing our friends. Awful.
Was there much fear when you went out on an operation?
No. On occasion, but generally not. I mean, I remember when the peace talks started, and or were going to start, and I think the strategy was to bomb them to the peace table. And the decision was made to attack the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. And we sent off our wing alone, 64 aeroplanes in formation, 64 Mustangs, and every wing did that, from the whole Air Force, Far East Air Force. And we were briefed to fly this route. And when we got near Pyongyang, we were to let down and fly in low level. And we were dropping napalm. And I remember as we flew over, and we were low, down sort of telegraph pole level, and we could see the muzzle covers still on the anti-aircraft guns. Of course, we caught them by surprise. And that was in the morning. And in the afternoon, we landed back. And I said, right, briefing so-and-so. Target Pyongyang. Same route, same turning points, just different targets. And we thought, oh. So off we went. And of course, this time they were waiting for us. And I saw all these, I thought, chaps dropping their napalms all over the place and turning away. And it was only when we got back to base and the debrief that I found it wasn't dropping napalms all over the place. It was aeroplanes being shot down and going in. We lost a lot of aeroplanes that day. They then mounted another, I forget how many days later, same routine, same. And then the guys began to get anxious. But generally, I think in all the time I was there and all the chaps I flew with, I saw maybe one lack of enthusiasm. He wasn't a coward, but he was just not enthusiastic about what he was doing. Generally, though, it's pretty good.
What were relations like with the Allies, like the Americans?
Tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. My big I learned one of the greatest lessons in my life when I got there. Having been born and raised in South Africa, and this was before the days of apartheid, but society was pretty well stratified, with the blacks, the African, occupying the lower levels. And we got to Korea, and I saw black fighter pilots. And they laughed and they cried and they fought and they died. And they got drunk, just like we did. Oh, I'd never seen that before. And then when I went to the infantry, we did a fair amount of fighting, and I saw that they were just as courageous. They had the same sense of humour. And when they were shot to bits, their blood was red like ours. And the guts stank, and death stank. Black, white, yellow, just the same. And that's, I think, one of the major lessons I learned from that war.
Were there any other nationalities apart from the Americans with whom you cooperated?
We used to see the Australians occasionally. I think it was the 8th Hussars, which was an armoured regiment, was based in their rear headquarters was in Seoul, and our forward base, which was K-16, was just outside Seoul, and we used to see each other on occasion. But other than that, no, we didn't come across them, although we would, you know, we supported the variety of the Commonwealth troops on the ground in close air support. I meant to tell you that our forward base was at Seoul on a small island in the Naktong River, and it was called K-16. And if you were carrying a heavy load and it was hot and there no wind, quite often you hit the ground again after you'd left the runway, so you didn't pull your wheels up too early. One end we had to climb over a bridge, and at the other I remember we had to ease away from factory chimneys, tall chimneys. We used to get the odd sniper firing. I remember getting back from a sortie one day, back at base K-10, which was our southern main base. Basically, you'd fly to K-16. Either having done a mission on the way, or you go way north, do your mission, and come back to K-16, and then fly for 3 days, and then go back to the main base for a day and a breather, and then another 3 days, and so on. And we'd get the... I came back to K-10 one day and asked where my... Because we had Korean batmen, I asked where my batman had gone, and they said he's been shot. He was a spy. And they didn't hang about.
But you said you got sniper fire into the
base. On occasion, yeah.
Did that do any damage?
No. No.
These were just pot shots, weren't they?
Yeah, I would think so.
Did you have any free time, or were you kept too busy for that?
No. I forget. I think it was when you'd done 25 or 30 missions. You were given a week R&R in Japan. And we'd go and stay on one of the American, I forget what they called it. But they, for instance, up we would check in at the Australian Hotel in Tokyo. And then we, friends I was with, we used to go up into the mountains, into the Sengoku Lake District, where the Americans had this fantastic, what would now be called a 5-star hotel, which had been built by the Japanese, but because we were occupation forces, they'd taken over that, and that was one of the R&R centers. And for a couple of dollars a day, you'd have a super room in this fantastic country. It really was very beautiful.
An incident here, you've put in your logbook, this is the 17th of July, you've put troops on our tanks waving at us.
Oh, yes, that was that? It. We'd been called to do a close support for one of the Commonwealth. I think it was British, actually. And we'd managed to overcome whatever it was bothering them at the time. I can't remember. But it was a lovely day, and we'd obviously won and done what they wanted. And they'd come out of their tanks, and so we flew by and waved at each other as we went past.
There was a notorious incident that happened before you got to Korea in September 1950, this was, when the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders were napalmed by the Americans. Can you understand that type of thing happening?
Yes. I mean, I went to the 19th Infantry Regiment, United States Infantry, when I finished my tour. And I always believed that close air support should never be given unless the forward air controller can see the target and the aeroplanes and talk to the fighter pilots. On occasion, this wasn't possible. And consequently, you could get a target that was not seen or in the sight of the forward air controller being attacked by the aeroplanes, and it would be the wrong target. But because they were close, he didn't know which was which. I mean, I remember at Suez, I was with 40 Commando. We went onto the beach next to the canal. I think 4 or 5 went on slightly to the west of us, and 4-2 did the first heliborne assault in history. And they were walking along the seafront, having landed, and I actually heard this happening, Royal Navy fighters attacking a target behind me. And I called on all the frequencies I had, and I couldn't stop it. And basically, they attacked the headquarters company on, it was 4-2 or 4-5 Commander, killing several. And what had happened in the confusion of battle, he'd been given a map reference, which was one square too far to the east. And this happens in war. I was going to tell you the infantry regiment I went to. On two occasions.
Was this in Korea? Or?
Yes, in Korea. I got there, not realizing that my predecessor, who had not been a ground attack guy, he'd been an F-86 pilot, so he'd done high altitude stuff, or not ground attack. Had managed to, I don't quite know how it happened, but the regiment had been attacked twice. But